change. One of these days.
Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of examining the financial and economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, the futures for our kids, what we pay when we buy things in the store, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. If you're interested in this program, I would like to also direct you to our websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. These websites, updated every day, are full of information, interviews, whole classes, literature, written material, audio and video material, made available for your use whenever you want at no charge. If you find this program interesting, if you want to pursue these kinds of analysis, those websites are a way to do that. Finally, both of those websites give you two other options. One, there's a way to communicate to us directly, telling us what you like and don't like about the program, what you'd like us to cover, questions you'd like us to answer. We cannot answer all of the questions. We get too many, for which we are grateful. But we do read every single email we get, because that's how we shape and design what this program is, how it works, what people we invite for interviews, and so on. And lastly, both websites give you an opportunity to follow us more closely and conveniently if you would like. Just simply click on the icon for the Facebook, Twitter, or Pinterest and connect with us in that way as well. We'll begin with our shorter updates, as we normally do, and I have three of those that I want to bring to your attention. One update has to do with a piece of research done by the Russell Sage Foundation, a very well-known and well-reputed research foundation, that studied what has happened to wealth in the United States, typical household wealth, often referred to as the net worth of a household. And what this does is it adds together all the property that a household has, subtracts from that whatever debts it has, and gives you then a sense of what the financial condition, if you like, of the house is in terms of its wealth. This is not about the income that's flowing in. It's about the wealth that's owned, the property that American families have. So here is the interesting thing. In 2003, I thought that was an interesting starting point. In 2003, the median household wealth was $88,000. That's what the net worth of American households were. That is, 50% had less than that, and 50% had more. 10 years later, 2013, the net worth of the American household, or the median American household, had dropped by 36% to $56,000. Let's do that again. Median net worth of American households in 2003, $88,000. In 2013, 10 years later, $56,000. That is an incredible drop in the, you might call it the savings, the wealth, whatever it is that a household in America has to fall back on if there are troubles with their income and their well-being. By the way, across this same period, the net worth of the top 5% of American households went up by 14%. So let's do that again. For more than 50% of our people, their net worth dropped by 36%. For the top 5%, went up by 14%. I'm sorry to throw all these percentages at you, but here's what it means. Over the last 10 years, and that, of course, means especially the last 5 or 6 years of this great crisis since 2008, Americans have been so damaged in terms of the income they earn relative to what they have to spend that they've basically had to eat up part of their wealth. They've had to reduce what they own because they had to dip into that to get by. That and the drop in the value of their homes, the most important piece of property that Americans have, if they have any, accounts for this dramatic drop. And it goes to show, yet again, that the talk about an economic recovery is a misplaced conversation. What it does is it focuses on the few numbers that look like they're going up and avoids confronting, let alone including in the analysis, all the numbers that are suggesting that the movement is actually in the other direction. There is no recovery, and the conditions of most Americans continue to be poor and deteriorating. Okay. The next topic I want to deal with has to do with a report issued in July, last month, about Social Security. The Social Security Administration issues one of these reports every July. And once again, we were told that looking at the flow of money coming into Social Security, all those payroll taxes deducted from us in the United States in our weekly paychecks, up to the first 113,000 or whatever it is these days, because beyond that, you don't have anything deducted. Every dollar you earn above roughly 113, no Social Security is taken from you. So the rich, of course, love that because they get the very high incomes. They only have to pay Social Security on the first 113,000. They don't have to take anything deducted for what goes above that for payroll tax. In any case, the Social Security Administration reminds us again that we're okay for the next 20 years, that even though the money coming in from payroll tax is not enough to pay out all the benefits that Social Security recipients are entitled to, there's enough built up, because in previous years more was coming in than was needed to pay out, that built up a fund, trust fund, and that can be depleted. So at least for the next 20 years, there's no issue of not having enough money to pay the Social Security outlays that people are entitled to. But then the question is, oh my goodness, what happens after 20 years? Well, after 20 years, if nothing else changes, one of two things has to happen. Either we don't give people reaching age 65 more or less, or 66 and 67, we don't give people eligible for Social Security what we promised them. We give them less. Why? Because not enough money is coming in and the trust funds are depleted. Or we raise the rate of taxation, payroll tax on people, because that'll lift the amount of money coming in, and then we wouldn't have to cut the benefit. So one or another of two things has to happen 20 years from now. Either we cut the benefits or we raise the taxes on people. And so there's concern about this, as there has been virtually every year. And then there are the proposals as to why this is happening and what we should do. I want to talk mostly today about why this is happening, although it includes what we should do. The most popular explanation for why this is happening is age. In other words, the argument is made that our population is changing. We're getting relatively more and more old people relative to young people. And that's a reason for a problem, because Social Security raises money from the young people, people of working age, 18 to 65, but it pays out to old people, people who are over 65 and who increasingly are not working. So if your young people from whom you get the money is relatively shrinking, and the old people to whom you give the money is growing, well, then you see there won't be enough. There are not enough young people to pay in the amount we need to pay what we promised to the old people. So it's nobody's fault. It's just the age distribution in our society that explains the problem. That's wrong. I mean, I could say it's a particular point of view, which is normally what I do, but that's just plain wrong. Why is it wrong? Does age matter? Sure it does. Is there something to this story about relatively fewer young people and relatively more old people? Of course. But that's only a part of the story, and not at all the biggest part. Here are the two parts that I would rather we focus on. Number one, Why has the money that we need to pay Social Security decades into the future, why has it not come in? It's not just because we have relatively fewer young people relative to what we had before. Here's a just as important, and in my judgment, much more important matter. We haven't raised wages in America. For the last 30 to 40 years, the real wage is flat. The money wage, what we actually get in our hands, forgetting for a moment the prices we have to pay. We're charged our Social Security based on the money wages. They haven't risen the way we thought they would. Wages have been stagnant in this country, remarkably so, for much of the last 30 to 40 years. And since Social Security is a percentage of your wage, hello, it means that if wages have been kept down by employers, which they have, because employers can substitute machines like computers, or because employers can move production out of the country, which terrifies the workers who still have a job here, so they don't demand higher wages, they don't strike for them, they don't mobilize in unions for them. So the employers have the last laugh, and they prevent wages from rising anywhere as much as they might have. And that's not just bad for the worker who doesn't get a rising wage, it's bad for Social Security, because if the wages don't rise quickly, neither does the percentage of them that is the income of the Social Security system. So the very policy of big business and business in general to hold down wage increases, famous, notorious for the last 50 years, is itself a major contributor to the shortfall of money in Social Security to pay what we're obliged to pay, what we ought to pay, that we're morally and legally required to pay to the old people who retire after a lifetime. So put the blame where it belongs. One of the major reasons Social Security is in trouble 20 years from now is because employers have kept down wages. And that suggests where the remedy might be, making those employers pay a larger percent than they now do of their payrolls into Social Security. That would be a compensation to the Social Security fund for what they've denied to that fund by keeping wages down. And don't get me started. What possible reason is there not to charge the payroll tax for incomes above $113,000 a year? The people who get $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, the ones most able to contribute to the social welfare of our elderly, ought to be doing it at the same rate as everybody else, if not a higher one. And that would change everything. And if we made Social Security a deduction, not just on your wages and salaries, but also on your interest income, your dividend income, and those other kinds of another source. So if we were fair in our taxing system, and if we took account of the failure of wages to rise, we would know where to go to help the funding of the Social Security that is already inadequate, but that millions upon millions of our elderly, given a lifetime of work to this system, ought to be paid and ought to not have to worry about. Okay. At this point in the program, we usually shift, and I'm going to do that today, to one of the larger issues that we're going to treat in our program today. And the one I want to begin with might be called the economics of markets. You know, the market is something that is dealt with in American culture, and indeed in the culture of many countries, as if the market were some magical, divine, perfect instrument, as if letting the market decide was something that was morally positive, that was universally agreed to, that was unambiguously better than every other way of distributing things. I'm amazed. That's a kind of economic fundamentalism just as extreme as religious fundamentalisms are. It is a perspective which cannot see that markets have weaknesses and strengths, that markets have desirable and undesirable outcomes. Instead of facing that complex reality, it is simply a kind of dogmatic celebration of markets that, as I'm going to show you today, is fundamentally blind and ought not therefore to get support anything like what it does in our society. Market fundamentalism is more widespread than any of the religious fundamentalisms that you can encounter in contemporary society. And I'm going to talk about markets and the economics of markets by using an example. A few weeks ago, I was on an airplane between New York and Los Angeles. And because of the purpose of my trip, I was able to fly first class. Business class, first class was the same in this airplane. So let me describe what I saw and what I participated in. 16 seats at the front of the airplane were in a kind of separate compartment, separated by partitions from the rest of the airplane. The rest of the airplane was economy class, and these 16 seats at the front were business slash first class. The seats in economy were, the way they are these days in airplanes in the United States, pinched together, many too many, too little space between you and the person on either side of you, and too little space between your row and the row in front of you. Uncomfortable, inadequate, no way for human beings to spend many hours. The flight from New York to Los Angeles is 5 hours, more or less, and so you don't want to be in that kind of situation. In contrast, the 16 seats in business first class were completely different. Completely different how? Well, as follows. Every seat, you could press a button. I experimented with this, so I know firsthand. You could press a button, and the seat flattens out, and you lie down, which allows you to sleep. And if you're on a five-hour flight, and if it left early in the morning, as mine did, I was grateful for an opportunity to relax in a horizontal position and to sleep a little bit, number one. Number two, we have about the same number of servers taking care of our food and drink needs for 16 people as the remaining 200 had for them. So that we had endless service. You rang the bell and someone came immediately and attended to whatever you needed. There was no charge for anything you ate or drank. If you needed to go to the restroom, it was always available. There was no line to wait. All of that. It was, in short, much, much more comfortable, much more pleasant, much healthier. You name it, it was better. And since I didn't have to pay, that dimension of the problem wasn't on my mind. What did occur to me was to ask the question, which I think is a very natural question, although maybe if you're trained in market fundamentalism, you don't ask this kind of question very often, but I try not to be caught up in that fundamentalism, and so these questions occurred to me as I think they would to a child. Okay, if there are 16 seats on a plane that holds, say, 200 or 300 seats, and if these 16 are much more agreeable, much more comfortable, who, here's the question, who should sit on them? Who should get those seats? And I'm going to look now at a set of possibilities. Okay, let's see. Maybe the seats should go to the elderly people on the grounds that comfort and easy access to the bathroom, that there are a number of human needs that elderly folks have that mean they should be given a priority for those seats. Here's this another possibility. Maybe folks that are ill, people that don't feel well, that have an injury, that have a chronic condition, and so forth, they would be given those seats because their illness means they have the greater need for it. Here's another possibility. those who have never flown before. If this is the first time you've been on an airplane, well then, maybe there's something to be said for you to experience sort of the best possible air flight, rather than to be squeezed into the rear end of the plane. Here's another possibility. Suppose you're overweight. In other words, suppose it's a real burden to sit in those cramped economy class seats. Maybe you should have a chance to go on one of those 16 seats. Maybe veterans, people who have fought in the war, and people who are processing that kind of an experience, if they've seen combat, for example, or some other criterion could be developed to say, let's give these people that kind of a seat, because in a sense they need it more than others, they deserve it, etc., etc. Here's another way we could do it. We could have a rotating system. In other words, the airlines keep track of everybody who sits in a front seat. And they look at the folks lined up for any particular flight, and they have it in the computer. It's easy to do today. And they see who in those people that are paid a ticket and are on that flight, who of them have been in a first class or business class seat within the last, say, year, and who haven't. And if you have, you don't qualify. And if you haven't been in one, well, then you're on the list. And then we use a random selection procedure, very easy to do, to pick 16 folks. They have that chance. They sit on that seat for that flight. And then they have to wait at least a year before they're eligible again in a random drawing to do that. Meanwhile, those seats go on to other people who also have not yet had the... That would be a way of doing it. And finally, here's another way. We could have a system of points people get in their life. You get so many points if you're over 35. You get so many points if you're over 65. You get so many points if you've had a major illness. You get so many points if you've been a service person. And on and on and on. If you've been on a flight before, if you've had such a seat before. And everybody has points. And when you sign up, the airline looks at your points relative to the points of everybody else who signed up for that flight, and the one with the most points get the 16 seats. And when you do that, you lose a bunch of points, so you kind of go back earlier in line, and you don't get it so soon again. All of those are ways of allocating seats, comfortable seats in the front of an airplane. They're all possible. None of them was used in my airplane. In my airplane, the 16 seats were given to people who had one capability. They weren't older, they weren't sicker, they weren't needier, they weren't random, they weren't young people who had never flown before, none of that. They were the people who had the money. No one asked where they got the money or how they got the money. Did you work hard and save up for a year to make this flight? Did you inherit this money from somebody you hardly knew? Did you steal it? No one knows. No one cares. The decision about who gets those 16 seats goes in a market system to whoever has the money. The ones with the most money buy the seats. And the ones who don't have the money can't afford the seats, and they drop away. And among those who have the money, first come, first serve. And among those who don't have enough to pay several thousand dollars, which is what that seat cost one way and round trip, they're not in the running. They're not qualified. They're out. A market allocates things like airplane seats according to who has the money. And by doing it that way, you disregard, you deny, you disrespect age, illness, youth, randomness, sharing among everybody, none of it. You exclude all those, you just give it where the money is. Now, how could you possibly defend that? Well, here's one way, and the way that most conservatives would quickly respond. Well, you have to pay for the airplane, and it's more expensive for the airplane to have those 16 roomy, comfortable seats than those awful seats in the back, so you have to charge more money. Wow. To which my answer is really simple. Everybody could pay a little more for the airline tickets they have, and then you could still distribute a few more comfortable seats in any of the ways I listed. Everybody would share a little of the extra cost. They shared over the 200 or 300 other people sitting on that airplane. The amount per person would have been very, very small, much less than the price of the ticket they already paid. So you would then have everybody pay a little more and have a completely different and much more honorable, just, fair, compassionate way of allocating the comfortable seats. But suppose that were unacceptable. Suppose everybody else didn't want to pay a little more so that a few people, even some of them, would eventually get this seat. Well, then don't produce these seats. Don't do it. Make all the seats the same. Give everybody a little more room by having the front section be more or less like the section in the back, but a little less cramped, so that everybody can be a little less cramped. Let's make ourselves all equal rather than create a special place for a few of us and then just give it to the people who have the most money and deny it to the people who have all these other claims. You sure you want to allocate by markets? You sure you believe that's the only way to do it? It never is. It never was. Markets are one way of distributing goods and services. But they have a lot of problems and a lot of inequality and a lot of injustice. And the next time someone says to you, wow, the market, let's let the market decide. Be aware, please, of what it means when the market decides. Last point. For many years, before and after World War II, in the subway system of Paris, France, the subways had a class one and a class two. Each subway train had a bunch of second class cars and one first class car right in the middle of the train. And if you bought a ticket to ride the Parisian subway, you bought either a first-class ticket or a second-class ticket. The first-class ticket was more expensive than the second-class ticket. And there were conductors on the train to make sure that if you had a second-class ticket, you only went into one of the second-class cars, and that the only people who could ride in the first-class car were people possessed of a first-class ticket. And guess what? Because it was more expensive, many fewer people rode, so that even in the hot rush hour times of the subway in Paris, if you had a first class seat, a ticket, you would get a seat. You wouldn't have to stand. There would be plenty of room. It was more comfortable. It was better lit. You get the picture. By the 1970s and 80s, there was an uproar in France. You know, spring of 1968 had many consequences in France. It was part of a kind of revolution in the way French people thought about society. And one of the things that changed in France was a decision by the people of Paris communicated to their leaders that this was fundamentally grotesque. And one of the arguments given in Paris was this. If there's going to be one car that's more comfortable, that's better lit, better heated, less crowded, it should go to older people, pregnant people, sick people, veterans, injured people, the very list like I gave before. And if we don't want to do that, then it shouldn't be for anybody. But the idea that simply because you got money, without a question of where you got it, how you got it, or anything else, that's not an acceptable way. And the French subway system ended the use of first-class cars and has never resumed it since. We've come to the time of our break in the middle of this program. We will come back in a very short time. Please stay with us. This is Economic Update. Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update. And I want to continue in the second half of the program by dealing with another major issue along the lines of our discussion of the economics of markets before the break. The issue I want to discuss now is one that is a great deal in the news and that deserves much more attention than it normally gets, and also a different kind of attention. So I'm going to try to talk a little bit about the economics of immigration. Okay, and I'm going to use the United States as an example, although much of what I say applies to the many other countries that are experiencing an immigration process in their society. Let's begin. The vast bulk of immigration into the United States, for most of its history, has been working people. People who leave a country because the conditions for them, their economic conditions, are difficult. Getting a job is difficult. Working on the farm is difficult. The income you earn is really not enough. The prospects for you are very poor. You can't support a family, or you can't support them the way you wish you could. You would like to offer a better life to your children than is available. And so you hear about economic conditions in the United States, and you make a wrenching decision to yank yourself out of the family you're part of, the community you're part of, the church that you're part of, the friendships you've developed, the neighborhood, and go to another country, often whose language you don't speak, whose customs you're not familiar with, whose religion may be different from your own, and so on. Very difficult, very painful, very frightening decision, mostly made for a better economic chance. Yes, there are some people who come because they're politically persecuted or persecuted because of their ideas, and that's important. But the bulk of people who have come always to the United States, and indeed that's true for most countries, are coming because they want something very unsurprising, a better economic deal, a chance to work, a chance to earn an income, a chance to live a reasonable life. Well, that tells you why they leave where they come from. Why do they come here, wherever here is? And this now gets to be important to be clear. Those folks would not come to the United States or any other country to which into which immigration occurs unless they were told by somebody, and told repeatedly. You don't make this kind of a wrenching decision on one idea that somebody tells you over a drink some night. They only come if they are told and retold that there's an employer waiting for them, that there's a job waiting for them, that they can earn a living, that their labor is desired. Or if they're the child of someone, that they're the child of somebody whose labor is desired. So this gives us a clue as to one of the key causes of immigration, the desire of employers to have either more workers than are available in their own country, or workers whom they can pay less money to than the ones they have in their own country. One or the other or both things have to be true if employers are going to send out repeated messages, directly and indirectly, to countries from which people are leaving, that you ought to think about coming here, to the United States, for example, or to Canada, or to Britain, or to Sweden, or wherever we're talking about. That means that one of the drivers of immigration, the economic drivers of immigration, is the employer, corporations, those who want to see the workers come because they need more workers, or they need cheaper workers, or they need both. They're not very interested in whether and how these workers can get along with other people. They're not interested in whether or not these workers find good, mediocre, or awful housing. good, mediocre, or awful education for their children, safe or not so safe neighborhood, that's really secondary. They want to know whether they can get these workers to come here and to work, preferably for less than they've had to pay workers who've been here a while or who were born in the United States. So the more the merrier, you might say, is the attitude of the employer class towards immigration. Now let's look at it from the point of view of the workers already here, either born in the United States or been here for a while, although having come as immigrants at some earlier point. They look upon immigrants very differently. And that's not because they're different people, but because their situation in the economy is different. So for them, they say to themselves first, oh my goodness, all of these immigrants are coming and they're going to compete with me for my job. Number two, these folks are poor. They are coming from a place where they've gotten by with much less than we expect here in the United States, so I'm afraid they will be willing to work for less than I'm willing to work for, and that they're going to therefore be the choice of my employer at my expense. Number three, if these are poor folk and they crowd in, as poor folk usually do, to the housing they can barely afford, we're going to get a number of folks like this who may become dependent on government assistance for one kind or another, and that's going to come out of taxes on me, because that's the way our American tax system works. The rich get out of their share. The corporations who want these people won't pay the extra taxes, but I will be required to pay the extra taxes to support the public services for a person who may threaten my job. Plus, I don't want crowded neighborhoods near me. It makes life hard in the schools. You can see where the arguments go. The point here is not whether these arguments are accurate or not. In some cases they are, in some cases they aren't. But the point is, workers are in a fundamentally different structural position than our employers when it comes to the immigration of adult people who come looking for the job that the employer would prefer to give them at a lower wage than whoever it is he's employing now. And so we have here set up an ugly and unattractive struggle. And it gets more ugly and unattractive because there are groups in our society, and I don't want to justify them or excuse them in any way, who are hateful towards immigrants, not for reasons of economics. They don't like the religion of the people coming in. They don't like the skin color of the people. That is, they're racist and they're bigots for various reasons. They now find these folks, who are always there to some degree, but they now find a new audience among the working class folks who are worried about immigrants not because of their color or their religion, about which they care little or nothing. But they want someone to push back because they're fearful of what it will mean for them economically if immigration. So there begins to be a coming together of the working class opposition to immigration, anxiety about immigration, and the racist or bigoted groups that are set against it. Meanwhile, and that gets ugly, really ugly. And meanwhile, there's another kind of ugliness. The people at the top, the corporate leaders, the wealthy, the people who attend to them, their servants, directly and indirectly, begin to reproach the working class as if its opposition to immigration were racist or bigoted. As if your average working person had some moral lapse that a big wealthy person could reproach them for. This is really ugly now. You are now casting the working class, whom you have endangered with immigration, whose risks at immigration you are precisely pursuing because it advantages your profits. But instead of facing what threat you represent to working people, you dismiss them all as if they were all racist and bigoted, which they never were and which they aren't now. I told you it gets ugly. Well, what should we do? Well, let's look a minute historically at what has happened, and then we can talk about what we ought to do. Most of the time, the employers win. We know why that is. They've bought the two political parties. You can see it being played out in Washington now as the Republicans and Democrats fiddle and faddle over immigration legislation. They never quite make a decision. Meantime, millions and millions of people come to the United States, more or less able to continue to do so, often under terrible conditions, particularly recently with the children. But this is an old story. What I'm saying to you is the corporations win. They control enough of the political system that when they want heavy immigration from poor places, they get it. For most of the history of the United States, it was poor people from Europe who came here. Since the Second World War, the European movement has slowed and largely collapsed, but we get now from Latin America and from Asia and Africa a growing flow again, in the main, poor people, people looking for work. Even those with degrees who come from higher levels of income in other countries, they also come looking for work, and they are also prepared to work at lower than the comparable salary or wage in the United States. Workers have occasionally fought back with enough political muscle to stop immigration, or to slow immigration, or to limit immigration. But that's been rare. The victors have mostly been the corporate elite. And so we've had immigration. And so we've had an endless succession of tensions in our communities, divisions in our working class along ethnic lines that are not so different from the lines between native-born, recent immigrants, and long-ago immigrants. With all the tensions and all the injustice and all the pain and hurt that that has meant, particularly for the immigrants, but for everybody else involved. Is there a better way? Is there a solution? And the answer, as always, is of course there is. If we want, and it ought to be a we that make the decision democratically, of course, if we want to open our nation, past and present and future, to immigrants from other countries, then we ought to do so, but provide the mechanisms so that their arrival is not a threat to the people here, is in fact a blessing and a benefit as it brings more diversity, more variety into the food and the dress and the ways of thinking of the American people, enriches us with the cultures of diverse populations, rather than threatening our working people. And the way you do that is no one here loses a job or lowers their income because of an immigrant. An immigrant comes in and he or she will be provided with a job, an additional job, not a substitute job, and a decent income that's comparable to what people here get. So there's no question of what people here getting being reduced because of the competition from an immigrant. You bring in immigrants without threatening the American working class, and those immigrants will not have epithets shouted at them, will not have their children driven away. They'll be welcomed for the diversity and the difference that they bring to enrich this society. You want immigration to work better, then do it properly. And who should pay for it? Of course, the people who wanted the immigration in the first place. You want more workers? Fine. You want workers who will work less? No, that's not available. Let's bring immigrants in if we need more workers. Fine. Bring them in a way that enriches and develops their lives and ours, and make those who benefit by having an available labor force pay the freight for making it work properly. No more folks at the top giving lectures on racism when the exacerbation of racial tension is precisely what they've produced by bringing poor people in to replace workers in this country. Anything else is insincere, duplicitous, and dangerous in more social ways than I can count. Okay, in the time that remains for us today, there'll be some questions that I'm going to answer that have been sent in by you. And let me begin, as I often do, let me begin with a question that's very blunt and but very clear. And this question goes as follows. How much money have the Clintons raised to pay for the effort of Mrs. Clinton, Hillary, to become the next president of the United States? Well, I'm not going to comment on whether she is or isn't running. I don't know that any better than any of you do. But I was able to take a look at the question of money, and in particular, how much money the Clintons have raised. And I got two pieces of information I want to share with you. The first one comes from a story in the Bloomberg Financial News Service, dated July 21, and it gave the following statistic. Since leaving public office in 2013, Hillary Clinton, I'm quoting now from their report on the 21st of July, Hillary Clinton has been crisscrossing the country, appearing at events for charities, banks, and trade groups. More than a quarter of the speeches were paid, earning Clinton at least $6 million, or more than 30 times her annual salary as United States Secretary of State. A recent Time magazine story on the Clinton fundraising added together the amount that Bill Clinton has raised over the recent years, the amount that Bill and Hillary raised for their foundation that is active around the world, and the amount raised for Hillary Clinton's political races, past, present, and possible future. And the number in Time magazine, hold on to your hats now, is 1.4 billion with a B. Okay, so what can I say to amplify this answer to this person's question? Running for office in the United States, particularly high office, is extremely expensive. It costs billions, with a B, billions of dollars to do that, which means that the only people who can run for such offices are either the people who have billions of dollars. Michael Bloomberg, as mayor of New York, would be a perfect example. There are many other examples. Or you have to go out and find donors to give you as a candidate the billions of dollars you will need as contributions to you, to your political party, to independent political action groups under the laws that cover those things. And that means you have to go out and speak the way Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton are doing. You have to find groups who have money, and then you have to tell them what they want to hear, otherwise they're not going to give you any money. So you either have to have it yourself, or you have to pander to very wealthy corporations, groups, associations, organizations, and give them what they want to hear and prove to them that when you get into office, you will be friendly disposed towards whatever it is they want. And woe be it to you if you misrepresent. You can do that once, but you'll never get money again from these folks, nor from many others, if the word goes out that you take money and don't, in effect, pay back. which means that folks who either don't have billions themselves or are not able or willing to pander persuasively to those who do are out of the running. There is no way to square this arrangement with democracy. There just isn't. The proportion of funding that comes from average people is trivial. The proportion of money that comes from the richest is the bulk. You can't do it without that. You can get more or less from the average people, but if you don't get from the big ones, you're dead. Your political career is finished. We get the government that comes through this trial by fire, or better put, trial by money. As one comic once said, we get the best government money can buy. The next question I want to deal with today has to do with the concept of incubator. And the word incubator, as applied to worker self-directed enterprises, sometimes called worker co-ops or producer co-ops. This idea that I find very interesting, that we move in this country and other countries to a new way of organizing enterprises. No more a top-down, a tiny group of shareholders and board of directors make all the decisions of what happens, whether production happens, whether you move to another country, and all the rest of the workers, the vast majority of people in any enterprise are the workers, who have to live with the results of decisions they don't participate in making. That's the opposite of democracy. So the question is, could you have a democratic enterprise? Could you have an enterprise in which the workers collectively decide, one person, one vote, whether they move, whether they produce something else, whether they adopt or don't a technology, how they use the profits they all help to produce? I like that idea. And here's where incubator comes in. I don't ask other people to like it. I would rather other people see it in action. Let's have, across America or across any other country, lots of enterprises that are worker co-ops, that are worker self-directed enterprises. Let them be side by side with traditional capitalist enterprises so that everybody can see how they differ, can see as a consumer of what they produce, and can see as a worker within that enterprise. Would you rather work in a top-down, undemocratic enterprise, or would you rather be part of a collectively run, self-directed enterprise? Let us have freedom of choice. But in order to do that, we would have to have a national program that provides technical help, financial help to get worker co-ops going in all industries where it's possible, in all regions of the country, so that we really do give people a chance to see and therefore a freedom of choosing what they want in their society, for themselves, for their community, for their country. And then let us democratically decide what mix of democratic and undemocratic enterprise structures we want. And I'm happy to say I've been informed recently of several places that do that, that are geared up to help launch worker self-directed enterprises, worker co-ops. And I wanted to call out one of them that I learned about just a few days ago. It's called the Worker Ownership Resources and Cooperative Services, WORCS. It's in Los Angeles, and it's an institution that helps incubate, helps develop an infant worker co-op so it can become viable and live on its own, like an incubator does. Give them a look in Los Angeles. Worker Ownership Resources and Cooperative Services, WORCS. It's one more way that change is coming. Thank you very much for your attention. We've come to the end of another economic update. This is Richard Wolff thanking you for being part of this and looking forward to talking with you again next week.
But after a while, gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.